Just heard Good Life by the Soweto Gospel Choir, and then Sun Colored Eyes by Balthus, and now you're listening to Tarango by Uza. The U.S. Department of Treasury reminds you that saving bonds over 30 years old have stopped earning interest. Find out more at treasuryhunt.gov. That's treasuryhunt.gov. Enjoy the rest of Tarango by Uza. This will be my last song. I hope you enjoyed Goodie Bag this week. Tune in next week, Wednesdays 5 to 6.
University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
It's important for us to talk about this. We lose a lot of people who are committing these acts of violence, or sometimes just suspected of committing them. We lose them to the penal system. And so our sort of exposure to and participation in the gun violence that some participate in also causes loss. We're losing by literal loss of life. We're losing some to the system, and we're sort of contributing to, you know, the lack of strengthening of our own communities. And so the extent to which we can, you know, check ourselves in those respects, but also understand how, you know, the systems and structures have sort of set us up in a way to be violent towards each other, and we need to sort of be rechanneling that energy and refocusing it and towards, you know, more positive outcomes for us all to better build ourselves as individuals, as families, and as a community.
Dr. Tamika Gillum, Associate Professor of Community Health in the College of Population Health at the University of New Mexico. Recently, Gillum co-authored a study that examined the multi-level society factors that contribute to disparities in gun violence among African-American communities. The study utilized socio-ecological models to understand how different aspects of society, individuals, relationships, community, and societal influence a person's experience, behavior, and health outcome. Their analysis identified several risk factors across all sectors of their research model. Among African Americans, the author found persistent barriers to support services such as appropriate medical care and reliable transportation, as well as intrusive policing and chronic exposure to violence in their communities. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Gun Violence Among African American Communities, with Dr. Tamika Gillum, In Black America.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of additional things, at least, that we can do. I mean, we know there's lots of problems with law enforcement, but ways that can be addressed too. But, I mean, there's a point of investing more resources into these disenfranchised communities, things that can be done more on a policy level, and putting in funds to build up these communities, to, you know, to create better school systems for students, for our kids to go through, to create better sort of environmental spaces for us to just sort of feel good about where we live, to have additional resources and opportunities for our young people in the context of these spaces, to put in place even, you know, things like more youth positive development type programs that push back against these narratives of us as violent.
Dr. Tamika Gillum has over two decades of experience in studying intimate partner violence, health disparities, and gun violence. In 2021, gun violence was a major public health issue of growing concern in this country, with 48,830 lives lost to gun-related violence, documenting the highest number of gun-related homicides and suicides ever recorded. The African-American community is disproportionately impacted by gun violence and are almost 14 times more likely to die by gun homicide than their white counterparts. These disparities prompted Gillum and her team to further assess underlying causes of this inequity, seeking to clarify the factors contributing to this public health crisis. These include factors such as institutional racism, inadequate community health support in disadvantaged neighborhoods, and structural economic disadvantages faced by African Americans. Recently, In Black America spoke with Dr. Tamika Gillum.
Well, I was born in Michigan, but family moved to Philadelphia after, you know, plants closing and difficulty with the jobs or whatever. So I mostly grew up in Philadelphia, although I did return to Michigan for my master's and PhD studies. So, yes, did Michigan State. I'm a Spartan, go Green. I heard you almost say University of Michigan, so that would not have been okay, but that's our arrival, but yes, Michigan State. So yeah, and since then I've sort of been in a few different places where I've done research and teaching.
So what led you to major in, I guess, health education?
Yeah, well, actually, I am a community psychologist by training. And so I did my undergraduate studies in psychology, eventually discovered community psychology, which is sort of a smaller sort of baby of the field of psychology, even though it was founded in the 60s. But it takes a look at individuals within context, so it veers away from looking solely at individuals as the source of their concerns or problems, especially when we're talking about major sort of social issues. And so similar to what we did in the paper in terms of looking at the African-American community at these different levels, what factors are influencing violence, as opposed to just looking at, you know, that there's potential deficits within this community. No, it's about not only individual level factors, but also relationship, community, societal. So community psychology really looks at individuals in context and really also seeks to do prevention work in addressing many of these social concerns. So a lot of us look at sort of major social issues, and that really lends itself to community health as well, because community health is really about prevention and community-based research and looking at sort of larger scale problems and how do we do community-based intervention. And so most of my faculty positions have been in public health, in community health, but also some in community psychology as well. So I've gone back and forth a little bit, but it's mostly been in public health. But that is because, you know, my primary work, my research for over 25 years has been primarily in looking at intimate partner violence within racial, ethnic minority, and sexual minority populations. So here in the States, that's predominantly been with the African American community and African immigrant communities. And so because I view intimate partner violence and now gun violence as well as a public health issue, a public health concern that we should be addressing, hence sort of drew me into going more into public health and trying to tackle issues like this from a public health perspective.
Now, we're going to get into the study, but why is the African-American community particularly associated with this type of activity?
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's some of where the overlap between my intimate partner violence work and this gun violence piece comes in, as well as community violence, because based on our experience here in the United States, we experience a lot of risk factors, and we experience a lot of disadvantage. We experience a lot of conditions or circumstances that put us at increased risk for experiencing violence overall. Totally getting away from this narrative of the African-American community as inherently dysfunctional and that's why we have these problems. No, it's more so because we've been sort of put in conditions and circumstances that increase the likelihood that we're going to be exposed to these types of things. And so when we look at things like intimate partner violence, when we look at things like gun violence, poverty, for example, you know, we as a community experience disproportionate rates of poverty. Well, we know from research that poverty is associated, you know, poverty, living in poverty is associated with increased rates of violence in those contexts, right? So it's not just that African Americans themselves are more violent, but African Americans are more likely to experience poverty. One of the other papers I wrote looked at the intersection of poverty and violence in the African American community and other African diasporas, because that's one of those things that we experience. We experience residential segregation due to structural inequalities that disproportionately places us in communities that are disenfranchised, that have less resources, that subsequently experience more of these concerns. We also have the structural issue of racism, which leads to, you know, portrayals of negative images of African Americans, which some of us internalize and unfortunately manifest in terms of violence against each other. But it also then contributes to why we have increased rates of violence committed against us by police officers, for example. A lot of them are, you know, consciously or subconsciously buying into these negative portrayals of African Americans and viewing African Americans as more of a threat, and then consequently more likely to respond to their actions, even innocuous ones, to respond to them with violence. Same thing with, you know, our sort of peers when we live in even predominantly white neighborhoods, where, you know, a lot of our neighbors are exposed to some of those same negative images, those same negative stereotypes, perceive us as threats. So we're at increased risk regardless of where we go or what we're doing or who we're exposed to because of these different biases. It also places us in a position where, because we're in these spaces with more violence, there's more of a police presence in our communities, right? And so then that increases the likelihood even more that we're going, that our brothers and sisters and youth are going to be part of the penal system, but also just increases the likelihood that we're going to be exposed to police and police officers and the violence that they have inflicted disproportionately on our communities. And so all of these pieces sort of contribute to why we experience this increased risk and have more of these different types of violence in our communities, including but not limited to gun violence.
Was there a team that was part of the study that you conducted?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to always sort of work in teams, but for this particular one, it was a number of basically former students of mine that are also African-American and have different interests in terms of addressing African-American issues and concerns. And so one of them is working on her PhD at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County. Another, the other is soon to be working on her PhD as well. She has a master's. And so we all sort of, they contributed as well to producing this particular piece.
Now, when one thinks about gun violence, why is it that this particular or those particular events, you mentioned, you know, poverty and living in segregated neighborhoods, these particular events are particularly affecting African Americans, but also is there a systemic problem that has existed over the years that caused these type of activities to occur?
There's the legacy of slavery in this country for black folks, which subsequently led into Jim Crow, which subsequently led into other forms. I mean, that legacy has contributed to the disproportionate poverty that we experience as the African American community. It's contributed to things like lack of home ownership, the lack of generational wealth that we were able to accomplish, right? That is all sort of, that's been centuries in the making, right? So it makes it so that we, as a community, experience higher rates of poverty, right? And so that definitely is a historical circumstance. This narrative that we've painted over the centuries here in the U.S. of black men as brutes, for example, that goes, you know, sort of all the way back to slavery, of as folks who are animalistic, as folks who are prone to violence. Those narratives have sort of continued over the years, just in various different forms, right? And so, you know, we, on one hand, we can, you know, point to what's most often now referred to as implicit bias, which, yeah, definitely happens, you know, but sometimes it's explicit, but they won't say that. But those perceptions of, you know, African Americans as inherently dysfunctional, as violent, as brutes, as dysfunctional, you know, that goes back hundreds of years, and it's just manifesting itself in different forms in this space. We have a history of the history of redlining, which prohibited sort of home ownership in certain spaces for African Americans and sort of subjected them to certain types of neighborhoods and environments that to this day research supports those, most of those neighborhoods are still disenfranchised, receive limited resources that come into those spaces. And so a lot of us are living in communities where we experience a number of different structural inequalities, where not only, you know, violence is higher, there's less educational opportunity, there's less opportunity for advancement, our children, you know, I mean, we do have, obviously, public education, but in most of our neighborhoods, it tends to be subpar education, and students potentially don't feel safe in those school environments, right? So this whole space has put us predominantly in these sort of disenfranchised neighborhoods, where the conditions lend themselves to more violence being perpetrated in those spaces. So all of these conditions have historical roots, and unfortunately, we're still kind of far from properly addressing those issues, which would help with a lot of different areas. Now, if we were, you know, able to better address some of those concerns, there'd be, you know, more wealth for African American communities. There'd be stronger education. There'd be more advancement and opportunities. There'd be less violence. But we have yet to sort of properly address those historical wrongs that have sort of happened and those negative portrayals and experiences that have followed us for generations.
That brings me to my next question. Why is it important for us to understand these issues of gun violence?
It's important because on one hand, we're experiencing significant loss of life, right? We're losing our brothers and sisters as a result of this violence. And yes, some of us are, you know, a lot of it is perpetrated by us against each other, but again, it's because of these structural problems. And so, you know, we have significant loss of life. We're losing men, women, and children. You know, when you talk about research that shows that we're 14 times more likely to die by gun homicide, when you talk about our children being 20 times more likely, in some of the recent research, 20 times more likely to die at the hands of a gun, we're losing generations, we're losing fathers, we're losing mothers, we're losing children. And so, I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's important. Loss of life is only one piece, right? We also then, you know, there are a lot of people who experience gun violence and survive gun violence and deal with the physical and psychological and economic outcomes or consequences associated with that. So we have a lot of people in community that are experiencing the detrimental outcomes associated with their experiences of victimization by gun violence. We have a lot of people within our community. I mean, so much research supports that so many in our community have been exposed to gun violence, have lost loved ones to gun violence, have lost family members, friends, peers. And so, you know, that significant loss also impacts us all. You know, when we, it impacts us psychologically when we've experienced gun violence, a loss to gun violence. It impacts families and communities that, again, lose fathers, lose mothers, lose sisters, brothers, kids. You know, those psychological impacts affect us as well. And so when we think about sort of maintaining and building and keeping a strong community, it's important for us to talk about this. We lose a lot of people who are committing these acts of violence, or sometimes just suspected of committing them. We lose them to the penal system. And so our sort of exposure to and participation in the gun violence that some participate in also causes loss. We're losing by literal loss of life. We're losing some to the system. And we're sort of contributing to, you know, the lack of strengthening of our own communities. And so the extent to which we can, you know, check ourselves in those respects, but also understand how, you know, the systems and structures have sort of set us up in a way to be violent towards each other, and we need to sort of be rechanneling that energy and refocusing it and towards, you know, more positive outcomes for us all to better build ourselves as individuals, as families, and as a community.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment.
In the next próximo Tacos of Texas, tools of the taco trade, casos, discadas, y parrillas, oh my! Let's take a deep dive into the tools of the taco trade as we explore Tia Pancha Flea Market in Houston, Texas. You can find Tacos of Texas on KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And speaking with Dr. Tamika Gillum, Associate Professor of Community Health Education, College of Population Health at the University of New Mexico, and co-author of a study that examined multi-level sociological factors contributing to gun violence in Black communities. Dr. Gillum, is there a sense of numbness to gun violence in African-American communities?
Wow. I don't know that I'd necessarily say numbness, but I think a lot of us have just sort of take this as just
as a norm,
the norm. In the context of our spaces. And it doesn't have to be a norm. It should not be a norm. But, you know, the fact that it happens so frequently in our spaces, the fact that it doesn't get the type of media attention and resources that show that people care about what's happening in our communities, you know, all of those things sort of just contribute to this sort of notion of this is just sort of happens and this is just part of our experience. But we definitely don't need to see it as part of our experience. I mean, some of the research, the other research that we cited in the paper even spoke to, you know, children. We're talking about middle school children sort of resigning to the fact that they live in these violent spaces and then unfortunately experiencing this sort of hypervigilance and, you know, all the things sort of associated with that. And so unfortunately, I think we have too much viewed it as the norm because it happens so frequently, because many of us don't understand the many factors that contribute to it, and because the larger society has sort of viewed it as just a norm for us, right? And we definitely need to better push back against that. I mean, there's things that need to be done on a larger sort of societal, structural, policy level, but then there's things that we also need to do within the context of our communities to get it out there. No, this is not normal. No, this doesn't have to be our experience to help to better things in our spaces as well.
Obviously, law enforcement intervention isn't working. What are some of the suggestions that you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of additional things, at least, that we can do. I mean, there's we know there's lots of problems with law enforcement, but ways that can be addressed too. But I mean, there's a point of investing more resources into these disenfranchised communities, things that can be done more on a policy level, and putting in funds to build up these communities, to create better school systems for students, for our kids to go through, to create better sort of environmental spaces for us to just sort of feel good about where we live, to have additional resources and opportunities for our young people in the context of these spaces, to put in place even things like more youth positive development type programs that push back against these narratives of us as violent, that push back against these negative perceptions of African American communities. As we engage, we can better engage in efforts to build our communities, to build our spaces, to strengthen and empower our youth, to strengthen and empower our families. Can also, do better. The larger society can certainly do better in terms of the types of policies we have in place that make firearms more accessible in our communities. There definitely needs to be better efforts on the federal level to do better in terms of sort of controlling or addressing those types of things. We need to engage in efforts that help to reduce things like intimate partner violence, community-level interventions for men and boys around that help us to reduce the numbers of intimate partner violence that happen in our communities that place our women at increased risk for intimate partner homicide. We need better mental health resources and services for folks who've been exposed to intimate partner violence, for those of us who deal with, some of the consequences and challenges of living in a racist society and the psychological toll that can take, and how we can better normalize seeking and receiving that type of assistance from culturally responsive therapists that are better able to deal with the types of traumas that we experience and facilitate our healing, whether we've directly experienced this type of violence or whether we've experienced it vicariously through our living spaces or our loved ones. There's lots of different initiatives, things that can be done on our sort of individual and interpersonal and community level, but then also these larger federal initiatives that can help to better invest in and build up African American communities and spaces, reduce the likelihood of these guns getting into our spaces, and other sort of righting some of those structural inequalities that have limited our ability to gain wealth, to advance ourselves. Those types of things, as we chip away at those types of things, they have the potential to reduce the amount of violence that we experience within the context of our spaces.
Now, Dr. Gillum, you articulated what needs to be done. Do you see a willingness to do it?
Well, yes and no. We do a little bit better in terms of, some of our community leaders helping to take initiative in terms of creating positive youth programs, for example, attempting to work and build up our communities. I think more of us definitely need to do that, but some of us do, do those things. The things that need to take, and there are, when we talk about sort of creating more culturally sensitive trauma-informed mental health services, there are sort of some efforts to do that. We do need to do better at that. I was faculty once in a place that trained future licensed mental health professionals, right? And we did some of that, but we could have done better. So those types of things are happening. Unfortunately, the things that have to happen on a larger society level to sort of right some of these sort of historical wrongs that have happened to us, I think, are slower to come to fruition. And I think, when we talk about sort of investing in our communities, part of that is going to be, trying to get more elected officials that look like us and have our interest at heart into, you know, positions in the government to be able to make these types of proposals and to support these types of proposals that are going to put resources into our communities to help uplift our spaces. We definitely, you know, there doesn't seem to be enough interest on sort of the larger federal level in terms of investing in our spaces and what can be done to strengthen and better our communities. We need those initiatives that try to, you know, address those, you know, the legacy of redlining and how that's impacted home ownership and generational wealth for African-American communities. There can be better initiatives in place to address those as well. We aren't doing enough with that. We aren't doing enough with regulation of firearms and the types of policies and legislation that we can be putting in place to sort of start to curb that a little bit more. And we know that's a big political issue, is a divisive issue, but consequently there's been very slow progress on it. You know, the recent bipartisan act that was passed a couple of years ago was the first legislation in 30 years to, you know, try to address this issue of violence.
Couple more questions, Dr. Gillum. Is the gun violence issue in America, particularly indigenous to America, are there other countries facing similar problems?
Good question. So we're the worst of developed nations, of what they call sort of first world or developed nations. We definitely are the worst, which is very telling. Like, we experience the highest rates of gun violence.
Dr. Tamika Gillum, Associate Professor of Community Health in the College of Population Health at the University of New Mexico. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchive.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again, for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black, but I'm going to keep it brief. Come here. You really want to know who's out there controlling the weather? It's us, everybody. Have been since the 1970s. Really, the 1950s. Since then, climate scientists have been screaming from the rooftops that burning fossil fuels would have a warming effect on the earth, which would begin to affect the weather. And we called them kooks. Tree huggers, if you will. On top of old Oaky. Sorry, rewatching that, so Raven. Chelsea ate that in retrospect. But since the year 2000, hurricane intensification rates have shot up nearly 30%. And it's simple, really. Human-caused greenhouse gases emissions warm up the planet and its oceans. These storms then draw their strength from the warmer water, and they're then able to intensify from a Category 1 to a Category 5 in less than 24 hours, just like Milton did. And with this kind of trajectory, we can expect for Hurricane Helene and the Milton to become the norm. So if you're looking around thinking it's getting real day after tomorrow out here, you're not wrong. But it's not coming out of nowhere. Right on the heels of the devastating Hurricane Helene, which ran across six states, causing catastrophic flooding that swept away whole towns and has so far claimed the lives of over 230 people, Florida was hit with yet another record-breaking storm. Before making landfall, Milton's caliber and intensification to a Category 5 in less than half a day had Florida's leading meteorologists in tears behind the sheer force of the storm. With all of this, we've now sparked conversations on developing a Category 6 for the types of storms that have been brewing up across the Atlantic. And if you thought that we were going to be able to have at least one episode that had nothing to do with the election, giving us a breather to discuss other equally serious and pressing things, you thought wrong. I saw at least 750 of y'all up here talking about Kamala's only giving them $750. Literally pulling shit out y'all ass because the hate train is losing steam and turncoat lifelong Republicans are even switching sides. Let me tell you something. As Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris ain't got nothing to do with that shit. The actual president of the United States, who is still at work, by the way, y'all, ain't got nothing to do with that shit either. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is a government agency that handles disaster relief aid. And it is Congress's job to set the budget. So that $750 were just emergency funds meant to allow storm victims to meet their immediate needs like food, water, and baby formula. All to tide the folks over until they can actually apply for real aid for things like housing repair, for which they can get up to $42,000. Like, what are y'all talking about? It's the completely made-up internet discourse that does it for me. It's gotten so bad that FEMA has to take to the streets to defend their honor. Came to the Twitter and the Instagram to debunk the myths and even set up a rumor response page to get y'all together. But what really irks my nerves is the blatant disregard for who bears responsibility for the well-being of American citizens, whose well-being y'all jeopardize every day with these rollbacks on civil, human, and reproductive rights in an hour such as this. Now, some folk would stoop so low as to use tragedy to rage bait the uninformed just to sway votes. And y'all don't even care if y'all get caught anymore. J.D. Vance done turned fact-checking into a dig. Oh, here they go, fact-checking me. Yes, what are you talking about? Being wrong isn't even enough for y'all anymore. So quick to place blame when, yes, the government can always do more. But whole time, Trump and his cronies are still today in 2024 talking about climate change is not real. Do you want somebody who has absolutely no regard for the environment or millions of lives that will continue to ignore science to be in control of climate change initiatives or the lack thereof for the next 4 years? And that's only if he steps down. And that's not even assumption, conjecture, innuendo. In his first term, he rolled back nearly 100 policies that were put in place to protect this country's air, water, and land. But what's more, he pulled out of the Paris Agreement, which was established to help protect against climate change worldwide. And he did so because of the unfair financial burden he claimed to have on the United States. Even more than that, in his manifesto, the Agenda 47, the one he claims not to be as bad as Project 2025, he said he wants to increase fossil fuel usage and slow down the progression toward renewable energy because, well, I guess he feels the money saved is worth the strongest hurricanes mankind has ever seen, the far-reaching and unstoppable wildfires, and the street-melting heat surges. And once again, he pledges to leave the Paris Agreement when he's back in office. But somehow, that's the half-black lady's fault. What Tyler Perry had Maya Angelou say? When someone shows you who they are, believe them. 1970s, really the 1950s. Since then, climate scientists have been screaming from the rooftops that burning fossil fuel.
Hello. I don't know who needs to hear it.
Hello there.
Hey, y'all, what's up? A man was lynched yesterday. And he was lynched because his life was in the hands of one corrupt governor who refused to make a just decision, who denied this man his freedom and his life even after evidence was presented to show that he was proven not guilty, after the victim's family said we do not want him executed, after hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people from across the nation took action by making a call, sending an email, signing a petition. But again, this man had no accountability structure. And while we mourn the death of Marcellus Williams, I have to ask you to also direct some of your attention to another corrupt governor who's being taken to task for things that could affect all of our futures, who does have an accountability structure in place, and we're going to have to watch and wait and see if he does what he needs to do. So I'm gonna take you back for a second. Do you remember in 2020 how on election night we did not know who the president was? All the time was running together during that time, but do you know we did not know who the president was until November 19th? It took Georgia 2 weeks to count votes. And so this year, three election board members that are pro-Trumpers have gone behind closed doors with Republican ops, with election deniers in 2020, to change the rules about election certification in Georgia. I've already had a conversation with you guys about the Electoral College. In Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Michigan are the three big ones that if somebody wins like 2 out of 3, they're a shoo-in for presidency. So they're trying to take the biggest player off the board by basically saying that they can deny certification if they want to. And that is against the state law and the federal law. Election certification is not a suggestion. It is not a choice. It is a responsibility and it's mandatory. But what they're saying, that the rules that they have made have basically made them able to demand documents that don't exist or could take weeks to retrieve and review, fail to make a reasonable inquiry before the certification deadline, and also change the way they want to vote should they discover the vote is going the way they don't want it to go. And this isn't one of those conspiracies that sounds like it could have some truth to it, but it's too ludicrous to be for real. One of those guys, Rick Jeffries, was talking openly before all of this about seeking a position on Trump's administration should Trump win again. So impartiality is out the window. When Trump had his rally in Atlanta, he referred to those three people who changed the rules as pit bulls fighting for victory. And this is why, folks, I made a post a while ago about ways you can get engaged in voter protection. But with this being a poll watcher, a poll observer, going to state election board meetings and going to regular election board meetings, this is why we got to be engaged. I've never told y'all to snitch before, but street code don't apply here. You still have the opportunity to sign up to volunteer, and we need to be in these rooms because Brian Kemp has the responsibility to fire these people should, after reviewing the case, he find that they are guilty of something, which they are, plain as day, but we are in an era where our government is not listening to people. So at the very least, it is our hope that he has no choice but to take the recommendation of the Attorney General. But what we can do on the other side of that is be engaged and to be ringing the alarm.
Hey y'all, what's up? A man was lynched yesterday. And he was lynched.
There was a time before Roe v. Wade existed, and we know mm-hmm. what the outcomes look like. So you absolutely knew what was going to happen. You knew that women were going to die, and you knew that women of color were specifically going to die at a disproportionately higher rate because, as you stated, we have always had an issue with maternal mortality. Mm-hmm. And right now, you know, I represent the medical center in my district. Right now, they're having a difficult time recruiting students. Mm-hmm. Who even want to go into OBGYN. So now you have less doctors that are even going into that specific specialty, but people ain't stopping having babies. If anything, there's now more pregnancies, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that when I tell you the layers of complexities to this, there are layers that I hadn't even thought about. One of my constituents came to see me, and she runs a nonprofit organization that helps out single mothers. And so she said, Congresswoman, I'm getting calls at least 10 to 15 a day for women that need to be placed somewhere. Mm-hmm. She said, and when I had the conversation with her, she said, but last week I got a call and it was a 48-year-old unhoused woman mm-hmm. who was pregnant, doesn't have access to prenatal care. You're talking about someone who doesn't have access to any of these things. And while I can say that no one should be unhoused in this country as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But there are things that she was willing to do while it was just her. There was a time before Roe v. Wade existed, and we know mm-hmm. what the outcomes look like. So you absolutely knew what was going to happen. You knew that women were going to die, and you knew that women of color were specifically going to die at a disproportionately higher rate because, as you stated, we have always had an issue with maternal mortality. Mm-hmm. And right now, you know, I represent the medical center in my district. Right now, they're having a difficult time recruiting students mm-hmm. who even want to go into OBGYN. So now you have less doctors that are even going into that specific specialty, but people ain't stopping having babies. If anything, there's now more pregnancies, right?
Yeah.
So I know I'm late to this conversation about my Yale Organics, but I wanted to add my two cents before it was all said and done. Let me first start by saying Mayel has never paid me to do anything. I've never done a Mayel promotion or collaboration. They're not paying me to do this. I just combat mis and disinformation across the board, and this is no exception. So, first off, I want to say that there was a person behind the brand. Her name is Monique Rodriguez. That is the founder of Mayel Organics. Her and her husband have done a lot of work to make sure this brand serves community from jump, even now through today. So it was really difficult for me to see a lot of stuff that was happening on socials and have.
Hey y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm gonna keep it black, but I'm gonna keep it brief. It's about to get a little spicy, I'm not gonna lie, because this is one I'm sick of having to argue with you motherfuckers about. As you all know, I launched two nonprofits yesterday. One, a 501c3 called the Good People Collective, and a 501c4 called the Good People Party. Organizations where we essentially produce content for good. Good voting habits, good community engagement, and to do our community some good all around. And since I've announced this past Tuesday, you all have raised a little over $13,000. Can we do better than that? Sure. But beyond all the messages of support I have received, the resounding one is the recognition that Lene Benin cannot take on this fight alone. So today, I decided to bring in some good people to help me out and give you a taste of what you can expect from the online presence when it comes to the Good People Party. In the case of Amber Thurman, Georgia and North Carolina's abortion laws killed her. As much as 69% of Americans have said that they support a federal mandate to protect the right to abortion, conservative governors and governments keep doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on taking them away. Did you know Georgia was one of those six-week states? The 6 weeks that we've been told y'all is too early for some women to even know that they're pregnant? So in 22, when Amber Thurman left Georgia to get a dilation and curettage procedure done where it was illegal in North Carolina, she was given two abortion pills instead. She was late to the appointment due to traffic from traveling from another state, might I emphasize. eyes, so they could not hold her spot for the procedure. However, the second pill did not take as planned, and fetal matter was still left in her womb. So she started to develop an infection, and doctors in Georgia would not remove the infected tissue from her because it was unclear if medically assisting her after an induced abortion would send them to jail. So why are we only hearing about this now? Well, the committees that review these types of maternal mortality cases operate on a 2-year lag and are just now getting to cases affected by the reversal of Roe v. Wade. Amber's last words to her mother were to promise her to take care of her son, but it seems as though sob stories from the women's purview don't really shame her like they used to, so I invited 2 young men here to speak on this battle over abortion rights who don't even have a dog in this fight. They ain't thinking about no child support. They ain't even got nobody pregnant. Anyway, JJ, tell these pro-lifers what time it is.
Of course. Now, taking away from morality and high-minded arguments, let's talk practical implications. Now, if you want to talk about exceptions for stuff like rape and incest, many states have began requiring stuff like police reports. Now, I can think of 3 problems with this. First, there are no specific parameters on how long it will take to get that police report. Second, it's way more difficult to obtain a police report in the middle of an investigation that's not completed yet. And finally, it's estimated that only 21% of sexual assaults are reported to police because victims fear things like retaliation. Again, let's talk practically about what the criminalization of things like abortion looks like, especially for the Black community. Now, a lot of y'all like to talk about people like Margaret Sanger and how abortion is a ploy to get Black people to do XYZ, but let's really break it down. Of the 10 states with the largest Black populations, 6 of them have gotten very restrictive when it comes to abortion access or outright banned it. Now, Black people tend to make up the majority of people seeking abortions because of things like lower socioeconomic status, and Black women are also around 2.6 times more likely to die than white women while giving birth. So even if we are only criminalizing doctors who perform these procedures, then what have we just done? We've just criminalized a predominantly Black behavior yet again, which could lead to more instances of mass incarceration. These are all things you have to weigh practically when having this discussion. Regardless of what your feelings are, pregnancy is not sunshine and rainbows. Once again, to reiterate, your policy positions have practical implications.
And I have to stress that this affects an entire class of Americans nationwide. So this decision to leave it up to the states that came from the Dobbs decision in 2022 is as inequitable as it gets.
I'm about to learn y'all a lesson right quick. Nah, she not capping at all. Leaving rights up to the states is probably the worst thing that could happen. Like, I just don't understand. I think people forgot what happened in slavery. The South thought it was their right to have slaves, and look how it turned out. When someone mentions state rights, somebody's rights is getting taken away. People thought that segregation was a state right down here in the South. So when Trump appointed those judges and they overturned Roe v. Wade, Georgia being a pro-life state, they banned abortions. They had exceptions, but they didn't even adhere to those. And that's what led to Amber's tragic death. So when Trump says everyone wanted it to go back to the states, no, nobody wanted it to go back to the states.
And if you're still clinging to the state's rights of it all because you feel there needs to remain a system of checks and balances between the state and federal government, then I need you to do your due diligence and vote down. I keep telling y'all, we have to meet these elected officials with the same energy. We cannot be oblivious to the inner workings of policy and legislation, because one, I didn't even realize Georgia had hopped on the bandwagon this hard because Ryan Kemp's sneaky ass keeps soft launching conservative attacks on the state. But other folks, Gregory, Grexstifer, Ted, down in Texas, they are suing for the right to access medical records to see if women are traveling out of state or getting illegal abortions by seeing if anyone's records record that they were pregnant and now aren't pregnant anymore. Y'all don't got nothing else better to do? And while we're on the topic of states' rights, it's all very reminiscent of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 specifically, the law that made it mandatory for people to return runaway slaves to their owners even if they were in a free state. History is repeating itself, y'all, and it's up to you to know what's going on in your state, to do something about it in the booth and protect yourself. So Florida, I'm talking to you now. If you as the voting constituency do not vote yes on Amendment 4 in November, abortion access in the South is going to disintegrate. The only other states in the South where a woman can access health care is in North Carolina and Virginia, and them two can already only take 50,000 patients altogether per year because doctors are being stretched thin. Some doctors are not even choosing to do residencies in OBGYN or practice medicine in states with extreme abortion bans and never to completely avoid this whole going to jail business. Right now, this is what abortion by state is looking like in the South since the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Texas all have a full ban on abortion. Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina have the 6 weeks. The most comprehensive resource on this is on Planned Parenthood's website, but if you're anti them because of Miss Margaret Sanger and them, I cannot stress this enough. Google is your friend. All right, good people, you know the drill. Get in the booth. Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm gonna keep it Black, but I'm gonna keep it brief. It's about...
They gonna be in the comments with us.
Hey, y'all, what's up? Why are we getting another video? I want you to know that even though it seems like I've got all the answers a lot of the time, and why are we dressed like this? I am just as frustrated with the current state of our political climate as you are. Hold on now. So, I decided to throw my hat in the ring. Savannah, slow down. Hold on. Let me get serious.
I know that's right. But so yes, while I will never in my days run for office, I would like to help change the way we do politics as a community. Back when I first started getting paid to do content, I would have never imagined I'd be talking about or breaking down half the stuff I do now. But I did name my company From the Lot because I knew much more would be coming from that old raggedy parking lot made from Georgia. So, from out of the universe that is From the Lot, or as you may know it, Parking Lot Pimpin', I am pleased to finally introduce to you my two newest efforts, a charitable nonprofit organization called The Good People Collective and a nonprofit advocacy organization called The Good People Party. But you can call us Good People. With complementary missions, these two orgs work together to provide education on down-ballot voting, policy and legislation affecting our everyday lives, and how to engage the democratic process in every election, every step of the way, strategically, and on one accord. See, the enthusiasm about VP Harris' nomination or her likelihood to win the election is great for many, but it's not a long-term solution for any of us. I want a world where we begin to properly manage our expectations with wide-spanning reach in terms of our collective information and education surrounding civic engagement without having to use words like civic engagement. You know how I like to do? Give it to the people in the way that they need it and the words that they can understand and identify with. You know, make it digestible. However, I cannot do it alone, nor do I wish to. So I called in the cavalry. I built a cohort of Instagram and TikTok creators already primed to do this work, who know we don't have time to waste because really, it's all very simple. Our official launch is coming this Thursday, September 19th or 9/19. And we're asking you to support our work by giving whatever your version of 9/19 may be. It's getting harder and harder for content creators to speak up on what really matters and still make a living. With many brands and companies barring creators from saying anything about elections or world events, we need the people's support. So, to support our creators, our community block parties, and even our research, please visit the links in my bio, learn more about our orgs, and give. It could be $9.19, $91.90, $919 if you gotta like that. But if you only have closer to 91 cents, let's round up the other nine. Because if you check the follower count, even just giving a dollar could really give 700K off the strength of the people alone. All right, good people, I'll see you tomorrow. Hey, what's up? It's Friday and I'ma keep it black, but I don't know if it's gonna be too brief. Y'all are terrible. And by y'all, I mean the people still talking about they voting for Trump. Are you not embarrassed? Is it not embarrassing, eh? This man couldn't string two sentences together and kept reverting back to the immigrants like they was the boogeyman, the monster that lived underneath his bed, the claws that keep coming out from in his closet. I was at a watch party and he's supposed to talk about, oh, I know you writing those. I know you about to need analyzing. Analyzing what? There was no battle of wits here. There was only one wit present. What I will say is black women have to be what? What? Exactly. Twice as good, twice as prepared, twice as qualified to get half as much. And that's what we saw on Tuesday night. To have the former prosecutor, attorney general, senator, and current vice president up here with this former president, yeah, I ain't gonna lie, she ate that one thing among many things. But this raggedy and-all with nothing to say but captions pulled straight off right-wing internet memes and tweets somehow has the platform and feels entitled to the presidency. Meanwhile, VP Harris was adamant about stating her track record and literal experience with each key issue before answering the question, because all the more lucid, competent, and coherent she may be, she still had to get up there and remind people that she is the only one on that stage qualified to do the job. She had exact numbers, she had exact quotes, she did lie that one time. He lied 33 times to her one, but why would we get up there and spend about that false October 7th rhetoric? It's literally already been debunked, sister. You could have left that part out. It was clear she was taking a center, right-leaning position on several issues raised, like fracking, guns, and foreign policy in order to siphon Republican votes. She is trying to win a national election, I guess. But why can't we tell the truth about this country's relationship with Israel? And even if for whatever top secret reason we have to keep talking about them defending themselves, inquiring minds want to know, why do we always have to qualify Israel first? Why can't we lead with the ongoing devastation and human rights crisis and at least say that you are disappointed in your allies' approach and that's why it's time to get the ceasefire deal and two-state solution done? And before any of you run with that, mind you, Trump didn't have a damn thing to say about it. As we've been told y'all, sis even hinted in the debate that these autocrats and dictators want this man in office because he's easy to manipulate and degassed about literally everybody, including us. Do you really want to try your luck on that one? She did at least remain steadfast on Roe v. Wade and reproductive rights, climate change, and the economy. And I'm very glad he said it, but even if he didn't, it would have been very clear that Trump doesn't have a single slither of a plan. Came in there guns blazing about Kamala Harris not having a plan when she just got the promotion
2 months ago when, oh, I'm not president yet.
But in the 9 years since you stepped into office, you were president for 4 of those years, so he just told y'all he wasted your time and your tax dollars. The only plans he has are to give police back their power, install a national sales tax that'll raise prices on middle-class families by $4,000 a year, charge 10 to 20% more for things that come from other countries, making it even more expensive for Americans to afford anything from back-to-school supplies to gas to groceries, appoint more right-wing conservatives who support national abortion bans, presidential immunity, and want to eliminate same-sex marriage. And that Project 2025 shit is not going away. With it will come employers who can choose if and how they will pay their employees overtime. Restrictions on IVF and contraception and defunding Planned Parenthood. Removing healthcare protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Slashing Medicaid. Reducing food assistance. And raising prescription drug prices. I'm not done. It will also involve the gutting of civil rights protections in the workplace to enable discrimination of women, people of color, LGBTQ plus folks. It will cut budgets for low-income public schools and roll back support for clean energy and efforts to protect clean air and water. So it's not just the leftists and the liberals that are in danger, it's people who live in the middle too. Meanwhile, VP Harris wants to give more than 100 million Americans a tax cut. That's $2,500 for a family of four. Cap unfair rent increases. Her plan is to build out 3 million affordable homes. She supports the reclassification of marijuana as a Schedule 1 drug and is fighting to lower healthcare costs for all Americans and seniors and protect those with pre-existing conditions. So is a double standard that much of a golden standard? Y'all would literally have a walking hazard to the safety of our country's citizens, our military operations, our national debt, and citizens across the globe than a black woman who is the most qualified person to ever interview for the position. And I'm so glad we got off that misinformation train about VP Harris so we can get into the full scope of her career. But even as I come to learn more and more about her, I can tell you that I am never surprised. This is our standard. This is our bare minimum should we desire to aspire to greatness. This is what happens when black women lead. We are impeccable. It's a law of physics at this point. The overqualification required of Masaj Awar makes us damn near inscrutable. And she still had to stand there and have that man say, I'm speaking now. Sound familiar? Boy, your scary ass, whack ass, mouth breathing, tiny crow having ass, lying ass. What did you think they was gonna say when you started talking about month 9 abortions and migrants eating pets? Huh? Side note, Lindsay, David, y'all did y'all big one. The real MVPs for sure. His reliance upon dog whistling and fear mongering, i.e. she's doing transgender surgeries on illegal aliens in prison. What? Was a clear sign that he understands that the people who will vote for him do not care that he's a liar, a cheat, a criminal, only that he remains committed to bigotry. Which makes it crazy. Scary, really, to think about how close this election still is. She ran circles around him, baited him to perfection repeatedly, and it barely matters because of how deeply entrenched white supremacy is in this country. So much so that Trump is under the impression that they are weaponizing the justice system against him. And that's rich. The justice system ain't never not been weaponized, and you knew that when you leaned on the then Central Park Five to get them charged and convicted. You knew that when you said there were good people on both sides. And you knew that it just had never been weaponized against you when you sent the people to the Capitol, when you committed those impeachable offenses, when you set up the Supreme Court to give you your immunity, should you make it back into office. And now you're whining because you just found out that in a criminal justice system, sexually based offenses are considered especially heinous? Boy, we just lost James Earl Jones and Frankie Beverly, and you still out here running on fumes, fogging up my TV screen. We losing the wrong people.
A big legal debate right now over billionaire Elon Musk handing out million-dollar checks via his pro-Trump super PAC to one random American every day until November 5th. The catch? You've got to be a registered voter in a key swing state and sign his conservative-leaning online petition.
All you have to do is sign a petition in support of the Constitution. It's very straightforward. You don't even have to vote. You don't have to vote. You just have to sign a petition saying you believe in the Constitution, which if you already believe in the Constitution, you're just signing something you already believe, and you can win $1 million. That's awesome.
But the big bucks giveaway is, as the New York Times puts it, quote, testing the bounds of election law. I want to bring in professor of law and political science at UCLA Law School, Rick Hassan. He is also an NBC election law analyst. It's good to see you. Fair to say we've never seen anything quite like this before. Is there anything legally that says Musk can't do this or shouldn't do this?
Right. So there are federal laws that apply anytime there's a federal candidate on the ballot, which is what we have coming up in November, that say you can't pay anyone to register to vote or to vote. And so what essentially he's doing is he's setting up a lottery, and the only people who can participate are people who are registered to vote. So it's actually either creating an incentive for people to register to vote or a reward for them having already registered to vote. And it's clear that this violates the statute. And the Department of Justice has an election crimes manual specifically mentions lotteries as an impermissible basis on which to get people to register or to vote.
So, Rick, a former chair of the Federal Election Commission told the Times that because Musk isn't directly paying people to register, but instead paying them to sign a petition, even if it's only open to registered voters, he, quote, comes out okay here. I mean, you even heard Musk telling the crowd in Pennsylvania there that they don't even have to vote. He says, in fact, that twice. So I just wonder what you think the case might be. Is it strong enough that somebody might bring it?
Well, first of all, if you want to sign the petition, you go to sign the petition, you look at what the eligibility is, and also this is the eligibility to get those $100 payments from Musk. It says you must be a registered voter in a swing state. So imagine we have a contest. We say anyone can win $1 million if they wear a pair of glasses, but they also have to be a registered voter. Well, the glasses is just kind of a make weight. You're really saying we're going to give you a chance to win if you register to vote. This is a federal law. It would be enforced by the United States Department of Justice. I don't expect we'd see anything before the election. DOJ moves very slowly on their criminal prosecutions, but nothing would stop DOJ from putting out a notice saying that this kind of contest is illegal, just like DOJ recently put out a notice saying that states can't have wholesale purges of voters in the 90 days before the election because that violates federal law.
So, of course, rich people giving money to campaigns in one way or another is nothing new, right? But I wonder if you look at it big picture, if there are laws that need to be considered here. We're in a place we've never seen before. First of all, a lot more billionaires than they have ever been. Very publicly influential. Musk, for example, not only has money to burn, but he has X, formerly Twitter. Trump has said he'd make a new cabinet position for Musk if he's elected. So I wonder, are there laws out there? Do laws need to change because of the kind of changing influence we're seeing from people with deep pockets?
So to be clear, under current law, it's unconstitutional, thanks to the Supreme Court, to limit spending in elections. The Supreme Court decided that in 1976. They reaffirmed that in the Citizens United case in 2010. Congress tried to pass laws limiting spending by the ultra rich in elections. And the Supreme Court said that that's a violation of the First Amendment. So all the other things that Musk is doing, his work with X, his giving the money to the super PAC, those are all considered legal under current system. And then the question is, do we want to think about amending the Constitution to change the role of the ultra wealthy? But that's really very different than what Musk is doing with this lottery, which seems to be a clear violation of federal law.
Rick Hassan, thank you so much.
It's great to catch up, Jamie. How's business?
Good. Are you up to speed with the new beneficial ownership reporting requirements?
Sort of. What's it about?
It's a new initiative to help fight crimes like money laundering, fraud, and drug trafficking. A lot of small businesses like ours just have to report some basic info to the federal government about the real people behind them.
Does that include my cafe?
There are some exemptions for certain companies, but don't worry. There's lots of guidance on the government's website about who needs to file. Check out fincen.gov/BOI. Filing is easy and free. It took me less than 20 minutes.
Looks like I do have to file. Thanks, Jamie. It's great having a supportive business community.
Reporting beneficial ownership information helps protect U.S. national security. Filing is quick, secure, and free. And it's the law. Learn more at fincen.gov/BOI.
I always had to be so good no one could ignore me. Carve my path with data and drive. But some people only see who I am on paper. The paper ceiling, the limitations from degree screens to stereotypes that are holding back over 70 million stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time for skills to speak for themselves. Find resources for breaking through barriers at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
Hey, out there in Radio Land, you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, your favorite radio station. It is 7 o'clock. That means it's time for the radio calendar. Here are some things going on in our fair city. You can stop by the Pittsburgh Banjo Club's regular rehearsal every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Founded in 1988, the Pittsburgh Banjo Club is an all-volunteer band and organization that uses banjos, trumpets, tubas, and bass to perform popular music from the 1920s and 1930s. The Pittsburgh Banjo Club rehearses at the Allegheny Elks Lodge number 339, which is located at 400 Cedar Avenue in Pittsburgh's North Side. Food and refreshments are available. Reservations must be made by Tuesday at 5 p.m. for each Wednesday event. You can do that by giving them a call at 412-321-1834. Moving on to other music happening in our town. Preserving Underground is hosting I Am, along with Mall, Life Cycles, and Valletta. Signal Quartet will be at the Bantha Tea Bar. Combat will be at Roboto Project, along with New Here, Histrionic, and The Eds. The Buena Vista Social Orchestra will be at the Roxy, and Brian Kay and The Parkway are at Club Cafe, along with the Freeloaders and Reliable Child. Big Fat Head will be at Government Center, along with Same and I4A. Kississippi is at Spirit Lodge, along with Talker and Tori Silver. Robin Hitchcock is playing at Thunderbird, along with Imogene Clark. On Thursday, Girlwood will be at Preserving Underground. Roboto Project is hosting the You Suck Flying Circus, doing their last Pittsburgh show. They're playing along with Where the Forsythia Blooms. Mitchell Tenpenny will be at Stage A, along with Dylan Schneider. Wayne Graham is at Club Cafe, along with Vinny Palesi. Sorry, Vinny, I don't know how to say your name. Skirts are at Government Center, along with Wished Bone and Vireo. Mr. Smalls is hosting Soul Asylum, along with the Juliana Hatfield 3. Kitchen Dwellers will be at Thunderbird, along with Sickard Hollow. On Friday, Chris Farron will be at Roboto. Catfish and the Bottlemen will be at the Roxy, and at the Pittsburgh Winery. Calliope presents the Trey Wellington Band. Cativo will be hosting God Bullies, Airbreak, and Media Profit. Hunty Lights will be at the Club Cafe, along with Ryan Yinkst, Sean Harris, and William Sparks. Melinda is at Mr. Small's. Brown-Eyed Woman is at Thunderbird. And Brillo Box is hosting Hardcore Halloween with The Crosses, doing a Dekreutzen set, along with Microwaves, Illiterates, D. Rodillas, and Difficult Customer. You should go in costume because, you know, this is the weekend for that. In fact, you should just walk around all weekend in costume. On Saturday, Funhouse at Mr. Small's is hosting Old Neon, along with The Middle Room, Crash Nebula, and Panic Landing. TV Boo is at Stage A, along with Schlump, Smith, and Maport. Mr. Small's is hosting Jamila Woods and Tank and the Bangas and the Peter Cotton Tale. The Billy Price Band is at Club Cafe. Pop Music Fever Dream is at Government Center, along with Natural Rat, Rebel Revolver, and Pet Sitter. Moondogs will be hosting Billy Crane, who's having an album release show. Tiny Wars will be at Pittsburgh Winery, along with Liz Burley.